and ensured the preservation of your skin, she thought. Javed said,
They await us at the keep, my lady.
Again she found the strangeness of his accent an open question demanding an answer.
Who awaits us? She asked.
The convocation of the faith. All those who keep bright the name and the deeds of your holy son, Javed said.
Jessica glanced around her, saw Alia smiling at Javed, asked,
Is this man one of your appointees, daughter?
Alia nodded.
A man destined for great deeds.
But Jessica saw that Javed had no pleasure in this attention, marked him for Gurney's special study. And there came Gurney with 5 trusted men, signaling that they had the suspicious laggards under interrogation. He walked with the rolling stride of a powerful man, glance flicking left, right, all around, every muscle flowing through the relaxed alertness she had taught him out of the Bene Gesserit Prana Bindu manual. He was an ugly lump of trained reflexes, a killer, and altogether terrifying to some, but Jessica loved him and prized him above all other living men. The scar of an ink-vine whip rippled along his jaw, giving him a sinister appearance, but a smile softened his face as he saw Stilgar.
"Well done, Still,"
he said, and they gripped arms in the Fremen fashion.
"The lustration," Javed said, touching Jessica's arm.
Jessica drew back, chose her words carefully in the controlled power of voice, her tone and delivery calculated for a precise emotional effect upon Javed and Zebataleth.
"I return to Dune to see my grandchildren. Must we take time for this priestly nonsense?"
Zebataleth reacted with shock, his mouth dropping open, eyes alarmed, glancing about at those who had heard. The eyes marked each listener.
"Priestly nonsense!"
What effect would such words have, coming from the mother of their Messiah? Javed, however, confirmed Jessica's assessment. His mouth hardened, then smiled. The eyes did not smile, nor did they waver to mark the listeners. Javed already knew each member of this party. He had an earshot map of those who would be watched with special care from this point onward. Only seconds later, Javed stopped smiling with an abruptness which said he knew how he had betrayed himself. Javed had not failed to do his homework. He knew the observational powers possessed by the Lady Jessica. A short, jerking nod of his head acknowledged those powers. In a lightning flash of mentation, Jessica weighed the necessities. A subtle hand signal to Gurney would bring Javed's death. It could be done here for effect, or in quiet later, and be made to appear an accident. She thought,
When we try to conceal our innermost drives, the entire being screams betrayal.
Bene Gesserit training turned upon this revelation, raising the adepts above it, and teaching them to read the open flesh of others. She saw Javed's intelligence as valuable, a temporary weight in the balance. If he could be won over, he could be the link she needed, the line into the Arakeen priesthood. And he was Alia's man. Jessica said,
My official party must remain small. We have room for one addition, however. Javed, you will join us. Zebataleth, I am sorry. And Javed, I will attend this ceremony, if you insist.
Javed allowed himself a deep breath and a low-voiced,
As Muad'Dib's mother commands.
He glanced to Alia, to Zebataleth, back to Jessica.
It pains me to delay the reunion with your grandchildren, but there are, reasons of state.
Jessica thought,
Good. He's a businessman above all else. Once we've determined the proper coinage, we'll buy him.
And she found herself enjoying the fact that he insisted on his precious ceremony. This little victory would give him power with his fellows, and they both knew it. Accepting his lustration could be a down payment on later services.
I presume you've arranged transportation, she said.
I give you the desert chameleon, whose ability to blend itself into the background tells you all you need to know about the roots of ecology and the foundations of a personal identity.
Book of Diatribes, from The Hate Chronicle. Leto sat playing a small balisit which had been sent to him on his 5th birthday by that consummate artist of the instrument, Gurney Halleck. In 4 years of practice, Leto had achieved a certain fluency, although the 2 bass side strings still gave him trouble. He had found the balisit soothing, however, for particular feelings of upset, a fact which had not escaped Ganima. He sat now in twilight on a rock shelf at the southernmost extremity of the craggy outcropping which sheltered Siege Tabor. Softly, he strummed the balisit. Ganima stood behind him, her small figure radiating protest. She had not wanted to come here into the open after learning from Stilgar that their grandmother was delayed in Arakeen. She particularly objected to coming here with nightfall near. Attempting to hurry her brother, she asked,
"Well, what is it?"
For an answer, he began another tune. For the first time since accepting the gift, Leto felt intensely aware that this baliset had originated with a master craftsman on Caladan. He possessed inherited memories which could inflict him with profound nostalgia for that beautiful planet where House Atreides had ruled. Leto had but to relax his inner barriers in the presence of this music, and he would hear memories from those times when Gurney had employed the baliset to beguile his friend and charge, Paul Atreides. With the baliset sounding in his own hands, Leto felt himself more and more dominated by his father's psychical presence. Still, he played, relating more strongly to the instrument with every second that passed. He sensed the absolute idealized summation within himself, which knew how to play this baliset, though 9-year-old muscles had not yet been conditioned to that inner awareness. Ganima tapped her foot impatiently, unaware that she matched the rhythm of her brother's playing. Setting his mouth in a grimace of concentration, Leto broke from the familiar music and tried a song more ancient than any even Gurney had played. It had been old when Fremen migrated to their fifth planet. The words echoed a Zensuni theme, and he heard them in his memory while his fingers elicited a faltering version of the tune.
Nature's beauteous form contains a lovely essence, called by some decay. By this lovely presence, new life finds its way. Tears shed silently are but water of the soul. They bring new life to the pain of being, a separation from that seeing which death makes whole.
Ganima spoke behind him as he strummed the final note.
There's a mucky old song. Why that one?
Because it fits.
Will you play it for Gurney?
Perhaps.
He'll call it moody nonsense.
I know.
Leto peered back over his shoulder at Ganima. There was no surprise in him that she knew the song and its lyrics, but he felt a sudden onset of awe at the singleness of their twinned lives. One of them could die and yet remain alive in the other's consciousness, every shared memory intact. They were that close. He found himself frightened by the timeless web of that closeness, broke his gaze away from her. The web contained gaps, he knew. His fear arose from the newest of those gaps. He felt their lives beginning to separate and wondered,
"How can I tell her of this thing which has happened only to me?"
He peered out over the desert, seeing the deep shadows behind the Barakans, those high, crescent-shaped migratory dunes which moved like waves around Arrakis. This was Kadem, the inner desert, and its dunes were rarely marked these days by the irregularities of a giant worm's progress. Sunset drew bloody streaks over the dunes, imparting a fiery light to the shadow edges. A hawk falling from the crimson sky captured his awareness as it captured a rock partridge in flight. Directly beneath him on the desert floor, plants grew in a profusion of greens, watered by a kanat which flowed partly in the open, partly in covered tunnels. The water came from giant wind-trap collectors behind him on the highest point of rock. The green flag of the Atreides flew openly there.
Water and green.
The new symbols of Arrakis. Water and green. A diamond-shaped oasis of planted dunes spread beneath his high perch, focusing his attention into sharp Fremen awareness. The bell call of a nightbird came from the cliff below him, and it amplified the sensation that he lived this moment out of a wild past.
"Nous avons changé tout cela," he thought, falling easily into one of the ancient tongues which he and Ganima employed in private. "We have altered all of that," he sighed. "Oublier je ne puis. I cannot forget."
Beyond the oasis, he could see in this failing light the land Fremen called the Emptiness, the land where nothing grows, the land never fertile. Water and the great ecological plan were changing that. There were places now on Arrakis where one could see the plush green velvet of forested hills. Forests on Arrakis. Some in the new generation found it difficult to imagine dunes beneath those undulant green hills. To such young eyes, there was no shock value in seeing the flat foliage of rain trees. But Leto found himself thinking now in the old Fremen manner, wary of change, fearful in the presence of the new. He said,
"The children tell me they seldom find sand trout here near the surface anymore." "What's that supposed to indicate?"
Ganima asked. There was petulance in her tone.
"Things are beginning to change very swiftly," he said.
Again the bird chimed in the cliff, and night fell upon the desert, as the hawk had fallen upon the partridge. Night often subjected him to an assault of memories, all of those inner lives clamoring for their moment. Ganima didn't object to this phenomenon in quite the way he did. She knew his disquiet, though, and he felt her hand touch his shoulder in sympathy. he struck an angry chord from the balisette. How could he tell her what was happening to him? Within his head were wars, uncounted lives parceling out their ancient memories, violent accidents, love's languor, the colors of many places and many faces, the buried sorrows and leaping joys of multitudes. He heard elegies to springs on planets which no longer existed, green dances and firelight, wails and halloos, a harvest of conversations without number. Their assault was hardest to bear at nightfall in the open.
"Shouldn't we be going in?" she asked.
He shook his head, and she felt the movement, realizing at last that his troubles went deeper than she had suspected.
"Why do I so often greet the night out here?" he asked himself.
He did not feel Ganima withdraw her hand.
"You know why you torment yourself this way," she said.
He heard the gentle chiding in her voice. Yes, he knew. The answer lay there in his awareness, obvious.
"Because that great known unknown within moves me like a wave."
He felt the cresting of his past as though he rode a surfboard. He had his father's time-spread memories of prescience superimposed upon everything else, yet he wanted all of those pasts. He wanted them, and they were so very dangerous. He knew that completely now with this new thing which he would have to tell Ganima. The desert was beginning to glow under the rising light of first moon. He stared out at the false immobility of sand furls reaching into infinity. To his left, in the near distance, lay the attendant, a rock outcropping which sandblast winds had reduced to a low, sinuous shape, like a dark worm striking through the dunes. Some day the rock beneath him would be cut down to such a shape, and Siege Tabor would be no more, except in the memories of someone like himself. He did not doubt that there would be someone like himself.
"Why are you staring at the attendant?" Ganima asked.
He shrugged. In defiance of their guardian's orders, he and Ganima often went to the attendant. They had discovered a secret hiding place there, and Leto knew now why that place lured them. Beneath him, its distance foreshortened by darkness, an open stretch of Connaught gleamed in moonlight. Its surface rippled with movements of predator fish, which Fremen always planted in their stored water to keep out the sand trout.
"I stand between fish and worm," he murmured. "What?"
He repeated it louder. She put a hand to her mouth, beginning to suspect the thing which moved him. Her father had acted thus. She had but to peer inward and compare. Leto shuddered. Memories which fastened him to places his flesh had never known presented him with answers to questions he had not asked. He saw relationships and unfolding events against a gigantic inner screen. The sandworm of Dune would not cross water. Water poisoned it. Yet water had been known here in prehistoric times. White gypsum pans attested to bygone lakes and seas. Wells, deep drilled, found water which sand trout sealed off. As clearly as if he'd witnessed the events, he saw what had happened on this planet, and it filled him with foreboding for the cataclysmic changes which human intervention was bringing. His voice barely above a whisper, he said,
"I know what happened, Ganima."
She bent close to him.
"Yes? The sand trout."
He fell silent, and she wondered why he kept referring to the haploid phase of the planet's giant sandworm, but she dared not prod him.
"The sand trout," he repeated, "was introduced here from some other place. This was a wet planet, then. They proliferated beyond the capability of existing ecosystems to deal with them. Sand trout insisted the available free water, made this a desert planet, and they did it to survive. In a planet sufficiently dry, they could move to their sandworm phase." "The sand trout?"
She shook her head, not doubting him, but unwilling to search those depths where he gathered such information. And she thought,
"Sand trout?"
Many times in this flesh and other had she played the childhood game, polling for sand trout, teasing them into a thin glove membrane before taking them to the death still for their water. It was difficult to think of this mindless little creature as a shaper of enormous events. Leto nodded to himself. Fremen had always known to plant predator fish in their water cisterns. The haploid sand trout actively resisted great accumulations of water near the planet's surface. Predators swam in that Connaught below him. Their sandworm vector could handle small amounts of water, the amounts held in cellular bondage by human flesh, for example.